Welcome to Extreme Jeans, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Hello, Jeanies, and welcome to another edition of Extreme Jeans, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeJeans.com. I am Fisher, your radio roots sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Great to be back from the Federation of Genealogical Societies Conference in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Had a lot of fun there. I was the keynote speaker on the first day of the conference on Wednesday and met so many great genies there. It was a lot of fun. In fact, one of the people I met at the conference is Barbara Clemens, and she had an amazing story of discovery, and she's going to share it with you a little bit later on in the show. Then we're going to talk to a professor named Andrew Millard. He's from a university in England where they discovered a mass grave building a new building there. Well, he got involved and learned the incredible story behind these individuals who were buried there and their ties to the United States. You're going to want to hear that. Hey, don't forget to sign up for our weekly Genie newsletter, by the way. You can do that at ExtremeJeans.com or on our Facebook page. And you can get all kinds of great story links there, blogs from me, and links to past and present shows. It costs you nothing, so we hope you'll come join us and be part of our group. But right now, in the absence of David Alan Lambert, who has decided he'd much rather be in Disney World this week than on the show, we have a special guest host to help us out with our family histoire news. Filling in for David is the founder, the president, the troublemaker in chief of Reclaim the Records. It's Brooke Ganz. Hey, Brooke, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Fisher?
Terrific. Now, if you're not familiar with Reclaim the Records, she's out there championing the recovery of records that government entities are holding back from us so that we can actually trace down our ancestors. They're supposed to be public records. A lot of them don't want us to get them. And Brooke and her organization go nuts, even suing some entities in some cases to make sure we can get access to those records. All right. It is time for our family histoire news, Brooke, and where do we want to start this week?
Well, I was really interested in the story I read about a baby who was found abandoned in a phone booth 64 years ago. Obviously, he's now grown up, and he, at the request of his daughter, started looking into his family history to see if there's any way he could figure out the puzzle of where he came from and how he wound up abandoned in that phone booth all those years ago. So at his daughter's request, he took an ancestor DNA test, as many adoptees do these days, and he was very lucky. He found a first cousin match who was able to help him figure out who his mother was, and his mother is still alive.
That is crazy.
Reunited.
Yeah, she's like 85 years old. They're getting together pretty soon, aren't they?
They are. They're planning to get together. His mother, you know, she has some memory issues, but she's starting to remember some of the details. And it sounds like she was a relatively young mom. She was not yet married to his father, and his biological father was pushing her to say, I will only stay with you if we don't keep this child, unfortunately. And they abandoned the child, but then the father turned around and abandoned his mother.
Wow. I mean, you know, the DNA stories, they never end. And you think many of them are all kind of similar. But then you get some of the stories like this. I mean, found in a phone booth in 1954. And now he's actually meeting his birth mother. Incredible. All right. What else do you have, Brooke?
Well, one of the other stories I noticed this week was about archaeologists who were exploring a field in Kansas, a sort of a suburban rural area, plenty of houses, development, and they are realizing the land was built on what was a lost city, a city that was probably the second largest urban area in North America prior to the arrival of settlers. It is a large city that probably had something like 20,000 people living in this area for hundreds of years, and that was known from some writings by Spanish conquistadors, but was not really marked on maps, was not really mentioned that much in history books, and it's only now that archaeologists are digging up some land and realizing this was a very large settlement right here in, I believe it's southern Kansas.
Isn't that incredible? A lost city right there, yeah. And they're digging it up, and I guess it's turning into quite the tourist trap as they move forward with it, but it'll be interesting to see what they learn about it. Very early, very large Native American population right there.
Well, one of the other stories I was noticing actually comes from the Moscow Times, and this is, believe it or not, a story about a family reunion, but a very interesting family reunion. It is the annual meeting for the descendants of Tolstoy, the writer, and he has a family estate in Russia, and more than 100 people from all over the world come to this traditional gathering to get the whole family together. But what was interesting about this year's annual family reunion for Tolstoy's descendants is that one woman who arrived was her first time ever joining the group. She actually is Italian. She grew up in Italy. She's very attached to her Italian heritage, but she has this connection to the Tolstoy family. And it was very interesting for her, as she talks about in this article, to go back and reunite with the other parts of her family. One of the things she did is that she was able to find a suitcase of letters addressed to her mother from years ago that was hidden away because her family had some internal struggles and Tolstoy didn't approve of some of the branches of her family, which is why they were cut off for so long. And she was able also to find one of her ancestors' diaries from covering the events when she was a teenager between 1917 and 1921. And it was just a fascinating look at that time period and what it was like. So it's very interesting to read other people's family history stories, especially when they're from such illustrious parentage.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, you think she's in Italy now. She certainly identifies as Italian, and yet you couldn't be much more Russian than Leo Tolstoy. And now she's digging into the history and connecting with all these other relatives. That's what family history is about. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, and being reunited with all the other parts, which is great.
And before we go, Brooke, you got to fill us in. What are some of the latest things that you're targeting now through Reclaim the Records?
Oh, Reclaim the Records is always busy looking for new genealogical and archival records that were not made available to the public, even though they belong to us. They were created with tax money, but some of them have been locked away in various archives. And what we do is we work to get copies of them, which we put online for free use. One of the things we've been working on lately is New Jersey's Death Index, which is the index, just a list to everybody who died in the state of New Jersey in the 20th century. And we have a website to make it easy for people to look people up. It is newjerseydeathindex.com.
She is Brooke Gans. She's the founder, president, and troublemaker in chief at Reclaim the Records. And now you know why. She's awfully nice for somebody who causes so much trouble. Hey, Brooke, thanks so much for filling in for David this week. You did a great job. I think you have a future in radio.
Thanks so much. This was fun. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. As you may know, I was recently at the Federation of Genealogical Societies conference in Fort Wayne, Indiana, as a keynote speaker. And while I was there, I met a lovely lady named Barbara Clemens from Lombard, Illinois, who had a great story for us. And I thought we'd get into that a little bit today because it's pretty unique. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to Extreme Genes. It was great meeting you at FGS.
It was exciting to be there. What a great event.
Yeah, it really was. And there was a lot to learn and a lot of stories being exchanged. And the amazing thing, I think, is often the tale of discovery itself is often even more incredible than the story we find, you know? And you certainly had a story kind of like that. Take us through your background a little bit.
So I'm the story keeper in my family. My mom, my grandma were always telling stories. And one of the stories that both of them told me was that our ancestor, John Drew, was a Native American. My mom concluded that was true because she smoked a corn cob pipe.
Oh, wait a minute. So the corn cob pipe, this was the symbol of Native Americanism, right?
I guess so. To people in Kentucky.
To people in Kentucky. All right.
So the Kentucky Historical Society, which is in Frankfort, amazing place if you want to do Kentucky research. It's in Frankfort. And they host every summer an event called the Town Hall Meeting, and they have a contest. So last November, I entered this contest, and I said I wanted to know about my ancestor, John Drew, to find out if he was Native American, which was the family story, or which tribe. You know, there was
Sure.
some speculation. And kind of find his story because we had heard that he was a minister. And eastern Kentucky is a rough place. It's the Appalachian Mountains. So lots of hills for people to hiding. Was he hiding there because he was a Native American? Or what was the story? So the Kentucky Historical Society asked me for like a GEDCOM file and my DNA. And in May, I found out that I won and that I was going to be on a TV program that they were sponsoring that's going to be on PBS in Kentucky. About Kentucky ancestors.
Sweet.
So I was so excited, and we went down to their big historical museum, and they'd set up this art gallery to be like a TV studio. And ironically, it was filled with photos of unknown Black people throughout Kentucky, which is kind of cool to be there. And it was just like Henry Gates' Finding Your Roots program. They had a moderator, and they had a big reveal. And they had cards that I looked at, and then they had these little short clips that the librarians had done on locations outside throughout Kentucky, like at Berea College. So it was very exciting, and I learned about John Drew, my ancestor. It was a big reveal. I had no idea what they were going to say. I mean, I sat down, and there were these big 15-by-15-inch cards with a white one on top, and they said, don't peek.
Don't peek.
and don't peek. And I had invited other descendants of John Drew. I invited them through another John Drew descendant, and we had like 15 of John Drew's descendants sitting in the front row, which is very cool. They've driven from Indiana and everything to be there to learn about our mutual ancestors. So it was quite exciting. So she started to tell me a little bit about John Drew.
Now, was this a research team then that was on it?
They had four research librarians from the Kentucky Historical Society do all the research. And at the end of it, they gave me this like 2-inch binder with all the documents and a jump drive with more documents that were too big to print up. So it was kind of cool. And they told me after, they kept coming after the program and saying, we love this guy. He was so cool. And he was such a great man. And they were grateful to me for sharing his story.
Now, what years did he live?
So he was born in 1832 in North Carolina, which at that time could have been in Kentucky, as, you know, boundaries changed.
Yes.
But he starts showing up about 1840 in eastern Kentucky, which is kind of the migration path for many people out of Virginia and North Carolina.
Okay.
And in the first census, where his name is actually shown, he's shown as being mulatto. And mulatto is a term for being half black, half white. He shows up as mulatto from 1850 to 1870 in all the census.
Now, was he a free black? Was he a free black?
He was a free black, but he was a farmer, but he was also a minister. So there's this church organization called the American Missionary Association. It's huge in the South, which was dedicated to helping educate black and Indian children. That was their goal, to have education for everybody, for all children. That was the future. And he, John Drew, was really well educated. They actually gave me letters that he had written, which is super cool to pick up a thing and says, oh, he wrote these letters. I mean, letters he wrote about his work in the church and his work to teach and his work to build schools. And then
they had these originals in the archives?
They had found the originals through the American Missionary Association, and they had some of them in the archives.
Unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. I'm like, wow. And then they had clips from various books, because John Drew was an abolitionist. So he fought against slavery. And to do that in Kentucky during the Civil War was a very dangerous thing.
Risky.
Very risky. He really fought against slavery, and many of these abolitionists were taken out, and they were shaved and tarred for preaching against slavery. So a very violent time in our history. And then he and his wife were considered to be, and they showed me several clips from books that they were radicals. And I thought that was kind of funny, because I was sort of a hippie, you know. And the thing, I thought, my ancestor was a radical too.
Yeah. Well, but, now, when you use the term radical, is it because they were anti-slavery?
Because they were anti-slavery.
Okay.
And to be anti-slavery before and during the Civil War in Kentucky was a pretty dangerous thing to be.
Sure.
So he was drafted in the Civil War. He was with the Union, but he never served. He became a minister. And he was sent over to Camp Nelson, which all the colored troops were sent to Camp Nelson south of Lexington to be trained. And John Drew was sent over there to be their minister.
Now, they weren't former slaves at that point. They were slaves at that point, were they not?
They were slaves, or they were freed, or they were run away. But Camp Nelson's quite a moving experience to see this huge camp that was set up. And John Drew would be their minister, and at night he would set up tents and bring them in to teach them how to read and write their name.
Wow.
When you think about that, that was his goal, to teach them so that they could write their name and they could sign documents. So quite a story.
And which state was this in now? He was with the Union side?
Yes, he was with the Union. Kentucky was split. The majority were with the Union, and the Union had a huge camp south of Lexington, Kentucky, where they trained all their soldiers. And ironically, I had two other great-grandfathers who went through Camp Nelson, so that's kind of cool.
Amazing. But it got passed down now. Well, where did this Native American tradition come from in your family?
So after the war in 1874, there was a law passed that mandated segregation of schools, that the black children could not be educated with white children, and that became the law. And John Drew, having 14 children, was a little distressed over this, so he gathered his large family together. This is what the librarians at the Kentucky Historical Society kind of presumed happened. And he said, I want you educated. From this point forward, we are all going to be Indian. And I'm an Indian, and you're an Indian, and you're an Indian. And if anybody asks you on every document, you are now an Indian.
Did that show up in census records through the years?
It certainly did, because in 1880, John Drew is no longer a mulatto. He's an Indian.
Okay.
And all of his children are half Indian. And from that point on, they are Indian. And they carry this story with them, and their children carry their, and grandchildren all carry the story that we're Indian. We're not black. We're Indian.
And so it was passed on down the line. And this was because of the fact that his kids weren't going to get educated.
The thing was, his kids were not going to be educated unless he made them Indian.
So that was so cool
because he was such an educated man, and he, I guess, saw the writing on the wall. But he felt that he would, from this point on, take advantage of having his kids educated.
And he is your second great?
He's my grandfather's grandfather, so I guess he's my second great?
Yeah, second great-grandfather, 1/16th.
Yes.
Fascinating. So was this a common thing then among blacks in this area at the time to get an education, to say, well, no, I'm not going to be black, I'm going to be Native American?
You know, I don't know on other stories, but I know this was what he did. This is a very hilly region of Kentucky, and the blacks and the Native Americans, they live together in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of said, this is a rough life we have here, and we're all going to be harmonious and live together. And our feeling is, as with other Drew descendants that I've met, that they did coexist with the Native Americans on a great level.
Sure, and probably had children with each other, right?
I think they did. They certainly were educating their kids together.
Sure.
They were certainly focused on bringing their kids together to be educated and building schools. John Drew built the largest school in eastern Kentucky at that time, which is ironic because then the state comes in and says, oh, but your kids can't go there, but thanks for building it.
Wow.
So that's why he said, well, my kids are Indian, actually. So the Kentucky Historical Society did such a fabulous job of researching his life and his story and how brave he was. I mean, seeing his bravery to stand up against slavery, seeing his bravery to stand up so children can, all children can be educated and blacks can be educated, was quite an amazing event. And learning about his life, that life was hard.
Amazing.
He's just a really cool guy.
You're happy to have him on your tree. Well, I don't blame you. She's Barbara Clements. She's from Lombard, Illinois, and we met at the FGS conference in Fort Wayne, Indiana a couple of weeks ago, and I heard the story and thought, got to share this with the world. So, Barbara, thanks for coming on and telling us all about this.
Well, thanks for sharing the story of John Drew, the courageous abolitionist, slavery-fighting minister.
You are so welcome. You know, it wasn't that long ago, just a few years ago, on the campus of Durham University, they were going to work to build a new part of campus and came upon something that has led to an amazing project that actually has implications for people interested in their family history, not only in England and in Scotland, but also in New England. And the guy who got into this whole thing is on the line with me right now from Durham University in Durham, England, Dr. Andrew Millard. He is an archaeological science specialist there. How are you, Dr. Millard? Welcome to Extreme Genes.
Hi, Scott. Nice to be on.
So what were you guys building there at Durham University that led to all this?
So we were adding a cafe to the library, which is right in the heart of the historic town of Durham.
Okay. And in the process of this, your guys found something a little bit unexpected.
Yeah, the builders turned up human skeletons, which turned out to be a mass grave. So the archaeologists were called in, and we've spent the last few years looking at the remains and analyzing them.
And what did you discover about them? When did they date from? Who were they?
We discovered that this is a group of Scottish soldiers who were imprisoned in Durham in 1650 after the Battle of Dunbar in Scotland.
Okay, so this is your civil war towards the back end of it, right?
Yeah. So the English Parliament had captured King Charles I and executed him in 1649, and they decided that they would have a republic in England. The Scots objected to the English having captured and executed Charles because he was their king as well, and they decided to support his son, Charles II, as king.
And so what happened to these soldiers?
So it was clear that the Scots were going to invade England, so the English preempted it and invaded Scotland, and they ended up having a battle on the 3rd of September 1650, just outside the town of Dunbar on the east coast, which turned out to be a complete rout for the Scots. So the battle started about 5:30 a.m., and by 6:30, the English had defeated the Scots and captured 10,000 men.
Wow, and so these are people who were part of that battle?
Yeah.
So what more did you learn about them? This is a pretty significant find right there on your campus.
Yeah, we knew that 3,000 of these captured men had been imprisoned in Durham in 1650, and that at least 1,600 of them had died, but nobody knew where they were buried.
And now you found them right there on campus. That's crazy.
Yes.
So what did you do? You started researching these individuals, and you've come up with this great book called Lost Lives, New Voices. Who are the Lost Lives?
So the Lost Lives are these 1,600 men who died in Durham, and the 28 that were excavated that we were able to study. And the New Voices are 150 who survived the imprisonment, and they were deported to Boston in Massachusetts as indentured servants.
And so now you've got a story that goes to Scotland, to Durham. It covers the English Civil War and to New England here.
Yes.
That's crazy. So what did you learn? Did you start researching these people?
Yeah, so we started researching the people in New England. And it turns out that we know which ship they went on. We know that they departed London on the 11th of November, and they were in Boston before the end of December. But there's no passenger list surviving, which makes it really difficult to start tracing them.
And so you actually went to Boston to research some of these guys, and did you have any luck?
Well, we went to Boston after we'd researched them remotely, actually. But 63 of the men were taken on by the ironworks at Saugus, which is just north of Boston, one of the first ironworks in the New World. And in 1653 and 1654... that got into financial troubles, which led to a whole series of court cases. And you know what court cases are good for?
Yeah, lots of good records.
Yeah. So from those court records, we have some lists of names of some of the men and some testimonies from them about their daily life working in the ironworks.
No kidding. So you got this testimony, you got the names. And have you started to put together, did they have families?
Yep. So most of them served 7-year indentures. And after that, they were free to marry and to get land and become citizens. So quite a few of them had families, and there are thousands and thousands of Americans descended from them today.
That is crazy. So is this new material that you've discovered for people who might descend from them in New England?
Yes. We've been able to put together a list of men who were certainly prisoners and possibly prisoners, and to start putting together biographies for some of them.
And what did you learn about some of these guys and what their lives were like after they came over here?
Well, some of them end up right out on the frontier. There's a chap called Mickin McIntyre, who's quite interesting. He gets lotted the frontier lot. So he's in what is now York, Maine, but his lot is the last one. Beyond that is just forest, Native Americans, and then eventually the French in Canada. He had children, and right towards the end of his life, or maybe just after he died, his son built a house, which is called the McIntyre Garrison, which is the oldest standing building in Maine today.
Oh, is that right? Okay, so there are a lot of people who are aware then of the family, but they might not know the actual source of where he came from.
And actually, we don't know where he came from in Scotland, just that he came from Scotland.
Just that he came from Scotland and that he was one of these people who was sent over and indentured. But was that part of the public record up to this point, till your book?
Yeah, so it was known that he was one of these soldiers who were sent over. And then there are others. So he had a neighbor called James Warren. And if you go to the right part of the Vaughan Woods in Maine, you can see the site where his house was, which we went out and saw in the woods. He got into quite a lot of trouble because these Scots didn't really fit into the Puritan New England lifestyle. So
I don't think a lot of the Puritans fit into the Puritan lifestyle.
So he keeps on being in trouble. He was told off using profane language and being insolent to a militia captain. And then in 1689, a raid by the Native Americans, one of his daughters was captured and taken, sold to the French in Quebec.
Oh, boy. So it's still quite the adventure. Imagine that, leaving Scotland, going into battle, getting captured, then sent across the ocean to live with the Puritans, ending up out there in the wilderness and having your child taken captive by the natives. I mean, that's a movie.
Yeah.
And so have you had some contact now with many of the descendants of these people as you've worked on this amazing study?
So there's a whole Scottish Prisoners of War Society, and they have a website, scottishprisonersofwar.com, with lots of information about the men and their lives and what is known about their descendants.
Really? So we're talking now like 375 years or something like that, or close to it.
Yeah.
So how much new material is in there that was not previously known as far as the genealogy goes?
I don't know there's very much about the genealogy. There's a lot about the biography of these men, which is which is new. And they're pulling together the information from the court records about their various involvements with the law and their...
And a lot of that material, of course, means that you apply it to one, it applies to many, right?
Yeah. So we can start writing a sort of collective history of them, seeing how they work together. They stick together, these Scots. They must have been sold into 7-year indentures about the beginning of January 1651.
So they were fairly young men, though, at that point, of course, obviously,
yeah,
to be
soldiers.
Most
of them were young men.
Yeah.
But exactly 7 years later, or 7 years and a week later, when they're free, they set up something called the Scots Charitable Society, which is still based in Boston. It claims to be the oldest charitable society in the Western Hemisphere.
Oh, that's crazy. I had no idea. Well, the book is Lost Lives, New Voices. It's by Dr. Andrew Millard. And I guess you got several others who wrote this book with you, if you want to give them a little love. Yep. And all of them at Durham University.
Yes, we're all at Durham University.
And you can get the book on Amazon.com, yes?
Yes, like every other book.
There you go. Exactly. The best place for it. That's why it's almost a $1 trillion company, right? All right. Yeah. Thanks so much. Really interesting stuff. And I look forward to pouring through it.
Thanks.
And it is time to talk preservation on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. And Tom, that time of year is here once again. I mean, the leaves haven't really begun to change colors yet. Maybe in some mountainous areas, we're seeing some of that. But the kids are back in school. And we're, what, just 90, 100 days away from the holidays. And I know that people in your industry need to have enough lead time to get digitizing done in time for the holidays. And I thought maybe we'd go through some of those deadlines today.
Yeah, that's a really good topic because we have our own deadlines, but there's people across the country that have different deadlines based on what kind of equipment they have. Like a lot of people out there send us stuff to actually do their transfers. And so they have to have time to take it, prepare it, send it to us, and us send it back to them. So what you need to do is if you have all your stuff, don't wait till you're ready to take it in. Call your local place and, you know, ask them the right questions, find out what their deadlines are for things. So we're going to give you some general deadlines, what most people are going to be dealing with.
All right. I realize every year it's about the time we get to Halloween, you're saying, oh, too late for something. And it's always just like, wait a minute, it's just Halloween. I mean, we got almost 2 months to the holidays, but let's go through what are the things you need by Halloween to make sure that people get these things digitized in time for the holidays.
One thing that's really important, just because the time that it takes to do it, we don't have a lot of equipment, or floppy disks. And you think, well, floppy disks, who's got floppy disks? A lot of people have floppy disks, not so much for computer programs, but mostly a lot of times people had their photos back in the day put on those 3x5 hard floppy disks, and people have JPEGs and different things like this on those, and they have no way to retrieve them. So you send those to us, they take time to do because we have to make a new data disk for you. So things like that, you want to get in early, get them in by Halloween. If you have odd size formats, like you have those old disc cameras where you got one piece of film back that's a big round saucer type thing, those things we need by that time, 110 film, pretty much any of the odd size films.
Oh, that film with the circle and all the pictures around it, that was the worst stuff. I mean, what were they thinking in the 70s between the photo albums and those formats and the 110 and the disc cameras? Somebody was just out of their minds.
Exactly. The biggest reason for the sticky photo albums, they were just ignorant, I call it. They weren't looking to the future. They were looking for a day fix. And with the film, what happened is, you got to remember, the economy around the world was pretty bad at that time. So film was very expensive to purchase. So what they did, they thought, oh, instead of 35 millimeter, we can make something a little bit bigger that's one piece that can put all your pictures on, and then do these little teeny 110 negative and say, hey, we can do these little small cameras. And all it was a marketing thing to save money on film. But the quality is really, really poor, and they're a pain to do. They really are.
Oh, I can imagine. All right. What else is on your list for a Halloween deadline to get digitized in time for the holidays?
If you have a lot of U-matic, and what that is, if you used to work for a TV station or even in high school, if you made some cool videos and there's a word size shape to it, it's as big as a paperback and a little bit thicker. It's like about an inch thick and probably about 4 inches to 8 inches wide. Those are U-matic, and they'll usually have like a big U on it.
Yeah, this is all weird stuff, Tom. I mean, most people don't have this, do they? But you still get this.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. What else is on the list?
Okay, any kind of weird video formats that you might have that like are international type that don't play in the U.S., I would suggest those because we can do them, but I don't want to say, hey, you know, we're okay to Thanksgiving on something like that, and then we get buried because somebody brings us in, you know, these great big huge tubs filled with some odd stuff, and we have to do their job so we can be filled up in one day.
Right, and then you got Betamax, right, Video 8, High 8, Digital 8, all those would be in this category too.
That is correct.
Talking to Tom Perry, he's our preservation authority, about the deadlines that are coming up. Doesn't matter that we're still quite a ways out from the holidays, but we just talked about what you need to get in to have digitized in time for the holidays by Halloween. So what is that next deadline, Tom?
Okay, your next deadline is going to be the middle of November to the end of November. Middle of November, you're going to want to get anything done like 16 millimeter film, especially if it's sound on film because it takes longer to do. Any other strange film formats you might have that are in like hard cases, aren't on the normal reels, we have to like rewind for you. Any of your formats as far as mini DVs and things like that, I can tell you to wait clear to Thanksgiving. Some of these formats that are really popular, the biggest problem is the availability of equipment. And if equipment goes down, you have to fix it. Sometimes you can cannibalize parts, but the parts are getting slimmer and slimmer to be able to even get. So you need to get this stuff done. And I'm just scared that 5-10 years from now, a lot of these formats we won't even be able to do just because there's no more equipment to fix.
Right. And certainly your counterparts throughout the country are experiencing the same problems.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of us trade stuff back and forth. You know, we get something, they talk to us, say, hey, if you ever end up with a Panasonic XYZ Video 8, let me know because I've got one that needs such and such. If you have one that goes down that has another part, we switch parts back and forth all the time, but one day the supply is just going to dry up because Sony stopped making this stuff like 10 years ago.
All right. So we've got then odd-shaped film.
Any of that kind of stuff. If you have the 2¼ squares, any of those kinds, some of them are even actually being shot today. But when we're scanning big negatives, you got to realize a big negative all by itself at a high DPI could take 30 minutes to scan. If you got 100 of them, you know, that's a week's worth.
Wow. And expensive, too. So it's a good thing to get that in, though, early to make sure you have it by the holidays.
Right. 35 millimeter slides, anything like that, we'll probably be able to do right up through Thanksgiving without a problem. But like I say, once we hit Thanksgiving, all bets are off. So don't take a chance. And another thing you have to think about, if you're going to want to do some of this stuff yourself and get the equipment, you better start watching for it because some of it's like hen's teeth. You just can't find it.
So what happens after Thanksgiving? Can you bring stuff in? Is there anything you can still get digitized by the holidays by bringing it in after Thanksgiving?
There is. Mostly there's a lot of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth because people missed the deadlines. But photos we can usually do right up to about 2 weeks before the deadline, unless people try to buy their own stuff and they can't, and they bring us a ton of them because it's first come, first serve. And I've had situations where the week before Christmas, we were all caught up and could do stuff 2-3 days before Christmas. But then last year, 2 weeks before Christmas, we were so backed up, we just didn't have the manpower and the equipment to do anymore. So photos is one of the things you can wait till the last minute too if you have to. VHS we can do really, really fast if you want them to DVD. A lot of people don't understand. If we do VHS to DVD, it's very quick and easy to do. If you want a digital file also, like on a thumb drive, then there's another process that's involved that's going to take more. So if you wait too long, you might not be able to get that digital file that you want. And then if you want to take some digital files and merge them together and do editing in like Wondershare or Final Cut Pro or something like that, you're going to have all your segments put together. And if you want us to do it or one of your local production areas, you need to have everything done at usually at least 60 days before you're going to need it. So that stuff you have to have done by Halloween at the absolute latest.
All right. And mini DVs, I would assume, would be in this category as well. For after Thanksgiving, you'd be okay.
Correct. We can knock those out pretty quick.
All right. Tom, that's it. And by the way, this is our 250th show today, which is unbelievable. And you have been on every single one of them since we started this show in 2013. So happy anniversary, buddy.
It has been awesome.
And continues to be. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
Hey, and that wraps things up for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. Hope you enjoyed the guests. Amazing stories this week. But of course, thanks once again to Barbara Clemens and Dr. Andrew Millard from across the pond in England for their tales. And if you missed any of it, be sure to catch the podcast on extremejeans.com, iTunes, and iHeartRadio, and many other outlets. We'll talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.